At some point, a few years ago, I don't know who it was, somebody gave us as a family a sign to hang up. A sign to hang up. I think you were supposed to hang it up. Well, we did hang it up by the door of our house. And it said something like this: "Remember, as far as anyone knows, we're a nice, normal family." In other words, I think the meaning behind it is this: let's try and keep the truth to ourselves. Let's try and keep up the illusion that we're normal. Let's not let out the truth that actually we're all a bit bonkers. We can fight like cats and dogs. A dad shouts at inanimate objects, and sometimes we're not really very nice to ourselves. Let's keep that to ourselves. Let's remember, as far as anyone else is concerned, we're a normal, fairly normal, nice family. Well, I've noticed that the sign's no longer there. I don't know what's happened to it. Perhaps Lois just took it down because she realised that, it's pointless trying to keep up that illusion. Everyone knows that knows different. I do know that one or two of you, I think, have still got that sign up, but please be assured we know the truth. Well, why do I start like that way, in that way? Well, because I think we should all be thankful that God doesn't try and put such a sign up for his family. He doesn't try to make the Bible give the impression that his family are all nice and normal, that we wouldn't ever shout at one another, or that no one has struggles or battles or failures. No, the Bible is a wonderfully honest book, and God intended it that way. Tim Keller pointed that out, didn't he, in his message on Psalm 88 that we watched as a church a little while ago, that in the Psalms, God allows all sorts of things to be out there for all to see. He doesn't hide embarrassing, difficult times away. So if we try and think of it this way, David here in Psalm 13 writes a psalm about how he feels the Lord's forgotten him, about how he can't sense the Lord's presence, in which he speaks about the fact that every day he's sad and sorrowful in his heart, and how he cries out time and again, "How long? How long?" And you would think, well, that's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? I mean, that doesn't really reflect very well, it seems, on the Lord and his ability to keep his people and satisfy his people. It's like hanging your dirty washing out on the line for everyone to see, as the expression goes. And you're sort of expecting the Lord to sort of say, "Oh, thank you very much, David. That's a very nice psalm. Thank you for that." And when David turns his back, the psalm's in the bin. We're not having that in here. But no, the Lord wants this psalm not in the bin, but in the Bible, in his inspired words. He wants us to know, in other words, that this happens, that sometimes his people will feel like this and go through this, that in God's purposes, things aren't always plain sailing for God's people. God's people can go through times of real darkness and despair, extended times when prayer doesn't seem to be answered and God seems far off and distant. And he wants us to know what to do in such times, that it's all right to express that and say how you feel and tell God your anguish. And he also wants us to know that there's something to do even in the midst of that despair. Now, perhaps you're watching on this morning and you're not a Christian. Well, I just want to say to you that for me, part of the integrity of the Bible and what makes it so convincing to me is its honesty and its reality, that it's not a sugar-coated book. It has an authenticity about it that makes it ring with truth. This is life. And yet, this book is not only honest, but it also has the answers, the only soul-satisfying answers. So this is a psalm then, really, about what to do in times of trouble and despair, times when you feel as if God's forgotten you, you don't sense his presence, when prayer goes unanswered and the devil seems to have the upper hand and almost laughs at you. What does David do? Well, look at the psalm then. Let's look at this psalm. The psalm is divided up into three sections. That's helpful for a good proper three-point sermon. So verses 1 and 2, what does David do? He tells the Lord about it. Verses 3 and 4, he asks the Lord to change it. And verses 5 and 6, he rejoices in the Lord in spite of it. So that's where we're going this morning. That's what we're going to see this morning. So verses 1 and 2, let's look at verses 1 and 2 first of all. David, what to do in trouble? David tells the Lord about it. Now look at those first two verses. David is incredibly straight and honest with the Lord here, isn't he? There's no hiding his thoughts and feelings. There's no dressing it up. There's no, you know, David, how are you today? Oh, you know, not too bad, thank you. No, no. How does David feel? How does it seem to David? Well, it seems as if God has forgotten him. It seems to David as if God is not with him. He's not listening to him and not helping him. You know, those are the very things that the Lord had said he would do for his people, that he would remember them and visit them and care for them and never leave them or forsake them. And they're the very things that David feels that God isn't doing for him. He feels abandoned. He feels alone. He longs for the sense of God's presence, and yet he doesn't have it. There are other psalms, aren't there, where David talks about seeking the Lord's face and seeking the Lord's presence and knowing it, but not now. And then in verse 2, look, he says, how long, so verse 1, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? And then he says in verse 2, how long shall I take counsel in my soul? That word counsel could be translated plans, make plans. So it's as if his mind is full of thoughts and plans and ideas about how to deal with this, how to get out of this, and yet none of them come about. He's got thoughts about what he would like to happen, what he thinks should happen, and what he thinks God should do, and yet none of those come to pass. The NIV translates it, how long must I wrestle with my thoughts? This sort of turmoil in his mind as he wonders what's going on and why is God not answering and why does he seem to have forgotten me? And then he says this thing in verse 2, having sorrow in my heart daily. It's a strong word, that affliction, distress, anguish. In other words, day after day, sorrow fills David's heart. He's like a grieving man who can't get over his sorrow, can't get through his sorrow. And to top it all off, the end of verse 2, his enemies are rejoicing over him and rejoicing over his troubles and rubbing their hands with glee. Now, we don't know exactly when in David's life this was written. We don't know the exact circumstances. But it clearly seems, doesn't it, that more than one thing is coming on top of another. It seems that David's probably ill physically. Certainly death is possible. He also has other troubles. People are troubling him, his enemies. I mean, in a sense, it's quite helpful that it's not too specific, because that makes it a bit easier for us to take it to ourselves and apply it to ourselves. Sometimes it's helpful that it's more general and we can sort of take it for our own psalm. But then we haven't really mentioned, have we, those words that are repeated four times in these two verses. What are those words? How long? How long? How long? How long? This has been going on a long time and there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. You only say how long, don't you, when you can't see the end, when you can't see the finish. And that's one of the hardest things, isn't it? In times of trial and troubles, when you just can't see a way out, you can't see an end to it. It's been going on, and you're already broken by it, and yet it seems to be stretching endlessly ahead. So here we're being reminded, aren't we, of what believers can go through. Like David's the Lord's anointed. He's the man after God's own heart. And yet here he is. Perhaps you're going through such a time at the moment. Some of you are. Or perhaps you will, soon or later. A time when you feel, perhaps you feel this now, that God has forgotten you, and you feel that the heavens are like brass, and you can't sense the Lord. And you're going through troubles, and though you've prayed about them and pleaded with the Lord doesn't seem to answer. And what you try to do about it, or what you think the Lord should do about it, just doesn't happen. And your heart is filled with sorrow, and tears are on your cheeks every day. And you perhaps feel as if unbelievers are scorning you and laughing at you and saying, "Where is your God?" Or the devil is rubbing his hands with glee. And it's hard. It's hard going through trials, isn't it? But, I mean, at least if you know the Lord's with you, if you can sense that, it does make it more manageable. And there are times like that, aren't there, where we go through troubles and trials, and they're some of the most precious times of our lives, because we know the Lord with us and upholding us and sustaining us. But it isn't always like that, is it? Let's be honest. When you don't feel the Lord is there, when it seems so dark and the way so hard, and you feel alone, and it's even harder, isn't it, then? And this psalm is telling us that believers go through such times, trusting believers, strong believers. Well, what does David do when he feels like that? Well, he tells the Lord about it, doesn't he? He asks the Lord questions. He expresses how he feels to the Lord, what he's going through. And it's as if in giving us this psalm, the Lord wants us to know that he's big enough to handle that. Of course he is. We don't have to hide. If you can put it like this, when the Lord comes to us and asks us how we are, he's not just expecting us to go, "Oh, fine, thank you, not too bad." You do find that sometimes, don't you? Someone asks you how you are and you begin to tell them, and it's very clear that he just wanted you to say fine or not too bad, thank you very much. But the Lord doesn't do that. In fact, the fact that Psalm is here is surely an encouragement to do that, to cast our cares upon the Lord, to pour out our hearts to him, as other Psalms put it. And again, notice the heading of the psalm. I think it's significant. Part of the inspired text is "To the Chief Musician." That tells us this, that David didn't sort of write this psalm and he's rather embarrassed about it, and he tucks it away in his little special secret poetry box with "private" written over the top. No, he gives it to the chief musician and says, "Here's a psalm for you. Put it to words so we can put it to music so we can sing it." I mean, some ways I wonder what the chief musician thought when he read it. Oh, great! This is a great. What word music am I going to use for this? But that's the point, isn't it? We don't have to hide it away. The Lord's saying, "Tell me." So what to do when it's like that? Tell the Lord about it. David tells the Lord about it. Secondly, David asked the Lord to change it. That's verses 3 and 4 now. He asked the Lord to change it. Now, of course, the very fact that David is telling the Lord how he feels and what he's going through is in itself a sign of faith, isn't it? You know, he's still coming back to the Lord. He's still talking to the Lord. He's saying, "Lord, you've forgotten me. You've abandoned me. You're not listening to me. But here I am again. I'm telling you. I'm telling you. I'm talking to you." In many ways, it's a sign, isn't it? Perhaps we could say this, that how he feels is different to what he believes and knows deep down. Because he says, "Oh, the Lord's abandoned me, the Lord's gone," but he's still talking to him, isn't he? And you notice in verse 3, look at verse 3, notice how he addresses the Lord. "Consider and hear me, O Lord, my God." So though he feels God's abandoned him and forgotten him. He can't think about God without calling him my God. He still knows that he's bound to this God and in fellowship and relationship with this God, that this God is his God. And it's why he keeps coming back to him and keeps praying to him. And I've seen that in many of your lives, brothers and sisters from Great Ellingham, at least. That you've been through great trials and going through great trials and have many unanswered prayers and there doesn't seem to be an end to it. And yet you still say, my Father, my Saviour, my God, my Jesus. And you're still coming to church and you're still praying. You don't want to go to anyone else. Well, what does David ask? Well, he asks for it to change, doesn't he? He asks for things to change. It's not wrong to do that, is it? We know our circumstances are in the Lord's hands, but we don't have to go, well, this is where I am at, so I must just be content with that in one sense. We can still ask for things to be changed, for our trials to be taken away whilst we submit to them. So what does he say? He says, verse 3, look at verse 3, consider and hear me, O Lord. So he's asking for the Lord to listen. He feels that the Lord hasn't, but he's calling for that. And then he says this expression, enlighten my eyes. Now we might think that is about God giving him a vision, understanding, but I'm not sure that that is what it is. Of course, that's a good thing to pray for, but I don't think that's what he's praying for here. Let's just look at two places that this expression, the Hebrew expression is used. First of all, 1 Samuel and chapter 14 and verse 29. Jonathan, Saul's son, uses it in chapter 14, verse 29. Let me just read the verse, but 1 Samuel 14, verse 29. But Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. Look now how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. Now that countenance has brightened is the same. My eyes have lightened, literally. So you may remember that Jonathan and they've been fighting the Philistines. Saul's made a stupid oath that no one should eat anything or drink anything until all the Philistines are defeated. Well, they've been fighting all day and Jonathan's exhausted. Actually, he hadn't heard that oath that's been made by Saul. And he sees some wild honey and he has a bit and it revives him and refreshes him. And he says, my eyes have been lightened. Like you can see, I've got fresh vigour again. And so enlighten my eyes is a request for physical refreshment. David is, I think, is ill in some way. He needs to be revived and strengthened and refreshed. And he's still asking, though it hasn't come yet. He's asking again, enlighten my eyes. And then the other time it's used is in Ezra. So that's not long before the Psalms. You've got Job and Esther and Nehemiah. Ezra's just before that. And Ezra chapter 9 and verse 8 is a lovely little verse, actually. Let me just read the verse. Ezra 9 and verse 8. And now for a little while, grace has been shown from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a peg in his holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and give us a measure of revival in our bondage. So this is the people have, speaking about the people have been brought back from captivity. God in his grace has brought them back from Babylon and he's brought them in into the land. And they've known the Lord's help and they've known the Lord's grace and they've been given a peg. It's a great expression, isn't it? That really means a secure place, like a peg for a tent, a secure place in God's holy place. And it says that God, our God, may enlighten our eyes. So that's speaking more about God's blessing, his spiritual reviving of his people. That's why he's done it. And so I think David's asking for both those things, for physical and spiritual refreshment and reviving and restoring. Enlighten my eyes. That's what he asks for. That's what he longs for. And then why does David ask for it? Well, back in our psalm, look, verses 3 and 4, we've got three lests. Lest I sleep the sleep of death, lest my enemies say I prevailed against him, lest those who trouble me rejoice when I am moved. So he's putting his case before God, isn't he? Lord, if you don't do this, I'm going to die and my enemies will rejoice. Now, of course, David sort of has a bit of a unique role, isn't he? He's the Lord's anointed. God has made promises to him and promises through him. He has his purposes bound up with David, because from David one day the Messiah is going to come from his line. And so David is in a sense saying to the Lord, I could die and your enemies prevail. And, what's that going to mean for your purposes and plans? But the point I want to make is this, that prayer is about wrestling with God and bringing our arguments to God, as it were. Not just saying, Lord, will you do this? But he wants us to wrestle with him and say to him, why? What's bound up with these things? We don't sing it so much now, but when I was growing up, there's a hymn, it's in Grace. Come, my soul, thy suit prepare. Jesus loves to answer prayer. I mean, as a child, I thought, well, why do you really need to wear a suit to make your prayers more effective? But it doesn't mean that, does it? It means case. We use lawsuit, don't we? And it's saying, bring your case, bring your arguments to God. Ask, tell him what you desire and tell him why. And we saw a bit of that on Wednesday night with Hezekiah's prayer. He prays the Lord will deliver them, and he says that your name might be known in all the earth. Well, there may be all sorts of reasons, personal and greater, that we bring our prayers to the Lord. But to come back to the main point, David asks the Lord to change it, doesn't he? To bring him out of it, to enlighten his eyes. And you're allowed to ask for that. And to pray for God's deliverance and blessing and help. So David tells the Lord about it, and he asks the Lord to change it. And then thirdly, he rejoices in the Lord in spite of it. That's verses 5 and 6. Now, there's no indication that David's circumstances have changed in this psalm, that his troubles have suddenly gone away, that his prayers have been answered just as he wishes. But David determines now what he's going to do and why. He says in verse 5, as verse 5 begins, but I have trusted in your mercy. This is the bottom line, if you like. What is going to determine what David does and how David responds? It's this fact that David has entrusted himself to God's mercy. Now, that word translated mercy is the wonderful Hebrew word hesed, and it's sometimes translated loving kindness or steadfast love or unfailing love. It's a wonderful word. It's reminded this week that it carries sort of two ideas. It's something that's surprising and something that's steadfast. So there's something surprising and undeserved about it. It's God's faithfulness even in the light of our unfaithfulness. It's God's unfailing love even in the light of our often failing love. It comes to the fore in Exodus 32-34, where God declares his name to Moses. He's the Lord God, abundant in mercy, abundant in hesed, rich in this steadfast love. And of course, the context of that is that God has entered into a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai, and before the honeymoon's over, they've already been unfaithful. They've made a golden calf and they've worshipped it, and God will be perfectly just, perfectly right to destroy them, and yet, amazingly, he forgives them. Why? Because he's rich in mercy. He's rich in steadfast love. And when you're a sinner, when you realize you're a sinner, we all are, then you're so thankful when you understand that God is a God of steadfast love. You're thankful for the surprise of it, that your unfaithfulness has been met with God's unfailing love. And you realize that's what you need. And David is saying, well, this is where I am. This is the bottom line. I've trusted in your unfailing love. I can't understand everything. Your present purposes are a mystery to me, but I've trusted in your mercy, in that unfailing love. And that's what I've experienced. And that's what here's where I'm going to continue. It reminds me of Job, you know, in the midst of all his agony and trouble and darkness and despair, in the midst of all his questions, what does he say? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. David's saying that, isn't he? He's saying, this is how I feel. This is what's going on. I feel that God's abandoned me and forgotten me, and I can't understand, but I've trusted in his mercy. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And in the light of that, then, he has this confidence and expresses his intention. Verse 5, but I've trusted in your mercy. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. Now, does David mean by that, this is what I'm determined to do now? Or is he expressing his confidence that this is what he'll do in the future? That, you know, for now I'm miserable, but I will, you know, I shall rejoice in your salvation. Well, I think it's both. It means that now, in the midst of his sorrows and troubles, he's going to rejoice in his salvation. Again, it reminds me of Habakkuk. Remember those wonderful words at the end of Habakkuk? Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vine, nor the labour of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, nor the flock be cut off from the herd, and the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herds in the stall, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. You see, David is expressing that same determination as Habakkuk. It's a decision of the will that's fueled by faith. Even though these are the circumstances, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to rejoice in my salvation. And look at verse 5. It's not just a sort of, some outward pretend, unreal way. What does he say? My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. What does it mean to rejoice in God's salvation? Well, it means to rejoice that it's yours, that God's mercy, his steadfast love, means that this salvation has become yours. To rejoice in his salvation is to rejoice that you're saved, that your sins are forgiven, that the eternal things are secure. It's to rejoice in him, isn't it? Because what does the Bible say? The Lord is our salvation. The New Testament equivalent, rejoice in the Lord always. Rejoice in him. Make him your joy. By faith, look to him and rest in him. And then there is that looking ahead aspect to it as well. David knows that though these are his present circumstances, yet glory awaits. Salvation is his. And then David says in verse 6, I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. So David is going to sing. Now, when we miss singing together, and even when we get back together, it seems that we're not going to be able to sing immediately anyway for a while. But we can sing on our own, and we can sing in our hearts. And to sing is a blessing, isn't it? It's often a way to acknowledge all God's goodness to us. And so why is David going to sing? Because the Lord has dealt bountifully with me. Because the Lord is good and merciful, and my life is full of it. So we think, wow, well, this is the same man who's saying at the beginning, God seems to have forgotten me and turned his face from me, and I'm sad in my heart every day. And yet at the same time, he's saying, I'm going to rejoice. I'm going to sing. I'm going to do so not with just some blind optimism, but because of my salvation and because the Lord has dealt bountifully with me, I'm still going to rejoice. I still have things to rejoice in. I still have things to sing about. This is faith talking. Remember how those two things are brought together, aren't they, with Paul? Sorrowful and yet always rejoicing, he says in 2 Corinthians, isn't he? And we see here that the two things are not mutually exclusive. So what do we need to do in the midst of troubles and trials, even when we're crying out to the Lord? How long? We must at the same time trust in him, rejoice in his salvation and sing of his care. And whatever we have in our lives as believers, however great our suffering, however deserted we may feel, we need to remember that we'll never suffer as much as Jesus did for us. And we'll never be deserted in the way that he was deserted. So that even in the midst of our greatest trials, because of Jesus, we still have things to rejoice in. We still have reason to sing. So what are we to do in the midst of trials when God feels far off, when your prayers seem unanswered? Well, know from this psalm that God recognizes such times and such struggles. The Bible doesn't dismiss them or gloss over them. But the psalm also tells us not to give up, not to despair. Tell the Lord, keep talking to him, keep praying to him, keep pouring out your heart to him, keep asking him. But more, this psalm reminds you, even in the midst of that, without trivializing it, you can still rejoice. You're trusting in the mercy of the steadfast love of the Lord. Keep trusting. Keep saying, but I've trusted in your mercy. Live there. And in the light of that, rejoice and sing. If you're not a Christian watching on this morning, What do you have when your health goes? What do you have when the storms come? What do you have when pain and sickness grab you? What do you have when death approaches? The truth is that you ultimately have no foundation. You've nothing solid and sure. That's why you need the Lord. That's why you need the loving kindness, the his mercy. Deal with your sin and to reconcile you to God, to bring you into this family, and to bring you into this salvation that God offers to everyone and all who will come and trust in his Son. I'm so thankful for this psalm and pray that the Lord will use it to encourage us and help us and to give us thankfulness in our hearts that our God doesn't hide these things away. He doesn't want us to all go around and go, as far as anyone knows, we're a perfectly normal, trouble-free family. But he's willing to let us come to him with our questions, with our whys. And yet reminds us that in the midst of it all, we still have reason to rejoice.